Welcome back to episode 157. Am I correct? 157?
It is 157, Tim.
157. Okay. Well, this week we agreed to talk about this apparent culture revolution that's being attempted in the United States. We'll get into that. A lot of statues coming down, a lot of hating whitey, a lot of white guilt being institutionalized to combat white supremacy. Before that, we've had some recent developments. Looks like they're trying to do a COVID-19 redux or redo. recently, there's been a reported increase in cases. Of course, if you keep on testing, that's always going to be the case. And if they never, they keep talking about COVID deaths, and they've extended the flu season to all year. So now we get 121,000 supposed COVID deaths. We're familiar with the problem with that. But of course, we're in line pretty much with the regular flu season. Nothing really exceptional. There really is no increased death rate. Perhaps there's been an increase in the retirement homes, which might have something to do with some of the lockdown measures that increase the death rate in retirement homes. This week we had some number of developments. New York, Connecticut, New Jersey are requiring a 14-day quarantine for individuals traveling from states hit with coronavirus surge. The governors of New York, Connecticut, New Jersey on Wednesday announced that individuals traveling to the tri-state area from states experiencing a surge in COVID-19 cases will be required to self-quarantine for 14 days. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont, and New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy, in a virtual joint press conference Wednesday, announced a joint travel advisory which will go into effect at midnight that will require individuals traveling from states including from Arkansas, Alabama, Arizona, South Carolina, Texas, Florida, North Carolina, Utah, and Washington to quarantine for 14 days. I don't know how they're going to track that. Coming directly from the states. I mean, we don't have pass. We don't yet have internal passports in the United States. I guess these are flights, but how about if you're driving into the state or you've been to one of those places and then you're driving to the state? So it's nonsense. All individuals traveling from the states with significant community spread of COVID-19 into New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut must quarantine for 14 days, Cuomo tweeted. Now, I don't know what law he's citing. I guess it's just this vague universal powers that these governors have because we're in an emergency. But he said, Cuomo said, it's just common sense. We don't want to see the infection rate increase here. The criteria for states that have a high infection rate are 10 infections per 100,000 residents, although, the case rate is, I think, is over 98% asymptomatic. So I guess if you test positive, they're calling that a case. But if you keep testing positive for coronavirus, which isn't necessarily COVID-19, we all have these viruses in us, so it's kind of absurd. The false positives have shown to be above 80% on these tests. We have no reliable test for this anyway, but yet they're still relying on the tests. And they're still talking as if there is an increase in cases, that we might have to have yet another shutdown. But the original reason for the shutdown was based on the Neil Ferguson report coming out of the Imperial College of London, which has since been largely repudiated for horrible methodology. I've cited this before. Back in March, COVID-19 was taken off the high incident infectious disease list by the UK government. Nevertheless, 4 days later, the UK government imposed a lockdown. I think it was Neil Ferguson who said that many as 500,000 Brits could die, 2 million Americans. Of course, nothing like that had occurred. And of course, the data was, he never shared the data, and so it was, since there's been never any basis for that claim anyway, other than to create fear to create the lockdown. So if the original study has since been discredited, why are they even talking about the possibility of a second lockdown, much less delaying the reopening? Of course, this this tri-state deal between the three governors has been challenged legally, which, again, it is legally dubious to say the least. An attorney filed a lawsuit and seeking emergency temporary restraining order against Governor Cuomo on Thursday over the new restrictions requiring individuals traveling to the regions from states experience a large surge of coronavirus cases to self-quarantine. This is blatantly unconstitutional. Americans have the right to travel to all the states. They can't have internal passports or restrictions. Of course, all of this is based on this COVID-19 fear, which has basically been a media hologram. So they're trying to make a comeback in COVID-19, perhaps because the fear over black riots and protests is fading, and so the media needs another thing to stoke up fear for the summer, perhaps. Here we are in early summer. So what do you think is happening with this, Joe?
Well, I would mention that there are two things, and they get confused in the press. I mean, one is the Corona SARS virus, and the tests detect that, but the public sees cases. So the testing for the virus is given to the public as an example of someone with COVID, but this is simply incorrect. COVID refers to the cluster of symptoms. It's being sick, right? Mm-hmm. Now, it's obviously a gray area. I mean, some people are almost sick or nearly well, but this is one of the problems, is that you look at like some of the statistical models that have been created on what fraction of the population has already been exposed, and there's great controversy about this. Of course, we've never gotten around to doing any real testing in this area because, of course, that would like lift the kimono too much, I think, if they did it. But my point is that, so it could be like in California that in the entire population that over 10% have been exposed to it and will test positive under some tests for basically the SARS coronavirus, right? These are asymptomatic people, like 90% of them probably, 80, 90% at least. But if you increase testing into a population that has, you know, 10% infected with, or at least have been exposed to the actual virus, well, the amount of your testing will always go up by whatever amount you increase the testing by, right? You're going to get 10% more of the people, and if you double the amount of testing, you're going to get double the amount of these cases, and that's really what's being given to the public. The actual sick people are the data that's better, but even here it's confused as hospitalizations. But the problem is, I've actually talked to medical people here in the tri-counties that I know, and they say that a lot of the hospitalizations are basically panic driven. So what happens is, someone gets tested for COVID, they said you are tested positive, and then, you know, how are you feeling? The person goes, I don't feel too well. Well, you might want to go to the hospital. And so now suddenly you have a hospitalization.
Yeah, it's so, kind of funny. Years ago, I was talking to my brother. He's going to the doctor for the checkup. And every time you go to the doctor goes, his blood pressure would be highs.
Yeah.
So he immediately wanted to put on medication. My brother said, no, before I do that, let's see. Is there a way I can test my blood pressure at home? The doctor kind of reluctantly said, yeah, you can do that here. Okay, let me check my blood pressure at home, see how it is. Where it turns out his blood pressure went up when he went to go see the doctor because he got nervous at the doctor's office.
Right. I mean, exactly. So this is why hospitalization is not really good data. And then even ICU is not particularly good data. I mean, that may be a little bit more refined. But the problem is, you have this then you have the falsification of just any old sick person is COVID, right?
They get more money from the government.
And here, this fraud is like absolutely vetted. You know, people can do their own research and see what I'm talking about. When someone comes in now for just about anything, if you have like, you know, pneumonia, you are assumed to have COVID. Mm-hmm. You're just assumed, and you're actually put down as COVID in the hospital records. And they actually have to change that. They have to mechanically change it in order to take you off of the COVID number list. But the problem is they have been told that no one is going to check. They've actually been told this. The hospitals have been told we were not going to really be doing a lot of close checking to see, to verify if a patient was COVID or not COVID. We'll just accept your paperwork. Well, since they get more money if it's COVID, why in the world would a hospital not just go, well, we thought he was COVID. They're not asking any kind of testing. So by God, he's COVID. There you go.
Especially since they shut all elective procedures down.
It's the only way they can make money. So these things are all as a cluster organized to basically create a false epidemic. I mean, they're falsifying it in so many different ways. And they're doing it to basically create the justification for, first the lockdown, and now, basically to create the social chaos into which they could insert the Black Lives Matter Antifa riots, mm-hmm. right? And now they're going to be able to slow down the release from the lockdown because there's going to be a surge. So, you know, this is a very tough situation for the public. You know, I have people in my extended family, they're terrified of COVID. I mean, they have actually drank the Kool-Aid to the extent that they wear masks when they're driving in cars, you know.
Yeah.
They have been terrified and they are hysterical and they're not thinking clearly. So the government propaganda has been successful with a lot of people. And these people are, you cannot reason with them. You know, you can't say, well, why are you wearing a mask? You know, why are you afraid of getting COVID? You know, it's just, this is a disease where even if you accept all of the government statistics, it has a recovery rate of 99.975, right? Mm-hmm. Why would anyone be afraid of a disease like that? And bearing in mind that the, 0.026, which is, 25 people out of 1,000, which is dramatically overstated, as we've already pointed out, right? So say it's 1 in 1,000. This individual, 95% of these have comorbidity, right? So a healthy person would be driving a car with a mask on. I mean, it's simply preposterous, but they've been successful at this. It's all part, in my opinion, I mean, there's many different facets to this, but the primary one is just slave training. They have locked us down. They've gotten us to put masks on. They've gotten us to distance from one another. I mean, these are all attributes of slaves.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I still in my day-to-day dealings, I occasionally went into someone who meets me with a mask on or outside. And, it's like, this is a person who's they're usually reasonably successful, yet they've been trained. I'm like, where do you get your information? I mean, are you still watching the nightly news? Is this the problem? I watched a clip of Norah O'Donnell, NBC News, just like five. I just watched like 30 seconds of it. I couldn't take it. It was just so stupid. And so manipulative with the music, the scene. Not like you're getting useful information about the world around you. It's complete manipulation. You can see the mind control, the manipulation when you watch this. Yet there are still probably millions of people who still think they're getting something called news, from these institutions, which are all geared towards promoting the slave state. And it's amazing to me.
Yeah.
People can be that frightened.
We're creating our own slavery. So I had an act of rebellion. This was, very, meaningful. I was at Whole Foods. Now, it's a long story. You normally wouldn't go there. It's an Amazon-owned grocery store. But the store I would go to is not taking back the glass milk bottles that we have used, right? So we buy milk in glass. We buy raw milk. It comes in glass. So we buy it at this particular store. And they, because of COVID, are not taking our glass bottles back. And it's $2 a bottle. And it bugs us to see this big lump of glass bottles in our closet. So I went back to Whole Foods because they sell the same milk. And they say, sure, we'll take them back. They're a big company. Amazon runs them, Bezos must clean the bottles or something. Anyway, so yeah. I get in there and I am, you know, we're going to pick up a few things. And this guy comes up to me and he goes, sir, your mask is not on properly. Your nose is exposed. And so I say, well, okay, I have to, I mean, I'm wearing the mask. He goes, sir, you have to cover your nose. So what are you going to do? I cover the nose. Anyway, we go down the aisle, but I can't breathe normally with the thing on. So I flip it down so my nose is exposed. So anyway, we go to the check stand and the checker then starts to, you know, like basically it's a little more complicated than normal because they've got to wring out the deposit for the glass bottles. And this guy who is, I guess, the floor manager comes up and she asks him to help. And he says, I'm not going to do anything until you get your mask fitted properly. This is the second time I've told you. My mask had come down, you know, in the nose, the tip of it was exposed. And I said, okay, you're not going to do anything. And he goes, no, not until your nose is covered. And I said, okay. I said, okay, guess what? Don't do anything. Keep your groceries and you can keep the glass bottles too. And I walked out. So this was the small protest, you know, that, you know, I mean, I thought about it in the car on the way home and I was angry because I'd left my 8 bottles at $2 a pop with them. But I thought, you know, at least something, you know, at least that I actually had some terse words. I mean, I didn't leave without telling the guy what a thought puppet he was, but I didn't get in his face. I just, you know, pointed out that he was just following his orders like a Nazi in the scary Hollywood movies, you know, that kind of idea.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I think that it's, you know, that's an example of kind of what, I don't know, you have to do stuff like this. You just can't accept this reality. It is slave training. It is based in obvious deceit. And hopefully when you make little public protests in this fashion, when you stand up for being the one person in the experiment who knows that it's not a blue ball, it's a red ball, that someone out there, some mind will connect with you. You know, there are, like in Santa Barbara where I live, there is actually a collection of free spirits, you know, who don't buy it, who you know, are kind of in rebellion against the mask wearing, but not enough. And we'll just see how it goes. But as far as I'm concerned, you know, every chance I get, I'm just going to make a little bit of a stink because what else can I do?
It seems to me, my observation is the higher you up on the social ladder, or the more, status you enjoy in our society, the more compliant people tend to be.
Yeah.
You know, that's something I've noticed is that they, I guess they tend to have more faith in the system and the information they get. And
more to lose. I mean, they see themselves as part of the system. You know, they see themselves basically as, you know, equal with the oligarchs when, of course, you know, this is absurd, but that's the kind of a belief they have.
Yeah, because the revolution that's now being carried out or attempted in, which is the ultimate goal, is some sort of great reset that they have planned. They're not going to, you know, they're not going to be in the club, as they say. You know, it's they're the ones who can be really dispossessed, and you know. But I guess as long as people figure they can cling to something, they're more resistant to resisting this. Or just opening up to it. I just don't know where we live in an age where there's so much information. Just, you know, where do these people get their information? That they think that any of this stuff, whether the maneuvers or these measures, you know, imposed by governors with no law behind them, look at these people with any legitimacy at this point? Because a lot of these governors, like Cuomo, they need to be frog marched out of the government mansion and put under arrest for some of these things. It's outrageous what they're trying to do.
It's illegal. I mean, yeah. They're illegitimate. But obviously, I mean, when, you know, looking at the, like, how organized it is, I mean, you know, you have the secret society with quite a roster among the political class.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think they have a majority. So basically, you're looking at a majority of the Congress people, the senators, the governors, as being controlled or not even needing to be controlled, just being part of the group. You know, they're lifetime actors. They, you know, come from Converso families. There's just some aspect of them that plugs them into, you know, the slave training. And with those guys, I mean, what can you do? You know, there isn't, you know, there isn't, we aren't, the public doesn't have any kind of legal recourse except to try to elect someone else. And you know, that's like in the case of Gavin Newsom, that's years away.
Yeah.
So,
well, yeah. Otherwise, I mean, you'd be feckless not doing anything, but, you know, it's, you know, it's like the state motto for Virginia is Sic Semper Tyrannis. And, you know, and it's a reminder to tyrants of what their fate may be. And it's a warning. And that's something that the public forgets. That just to rely on elections and the system to work, you can't just rely on that, because when the system is so corrupted, it's so infiltrated, all the laws, the institutions are going to be used against you. And there has been some revolt, like this recent, because of some of the this part of the issue with the recent riots and sort of this you could call it like a pogrom against the white America's white population that you've seen the past few weeks, is this war on the police, which is over just overnight the police became the target. And we went from COVID-19 to the race issue, and police being, even some of the president felt compelled to sign an executive order. Legislation is being proposed, unconstitutional, by the way, because policing is a state matter. But now, like down in Atlanta, where apparently they've had what they call the blue flu, it's basically a lot of the police go on strike, and two of the six precincts, people just aren't showing up for work anymore, because the police themselves are rank and file, realize that they're on the chopping block. They're being set up by some of these, you know, like these black governments in Atlanta or the liberal, you know, Jewish government in Minneapolis. They're being held out, you know, being hung out to dry, being used as a scapegoat for these things. And one thing that can be done is the rank and file simply say, okay, we're not showing up for work, we're sick, and then the system has to respond to that. That's one thing you can do.
You wonder how that would actually play out. It's a dangerous maneuver, because basically you're abandoning the streets. You know, as I would look at it, you know, you see something like, you know, the projects, the military type projects, you know, like Enduring Freedom, you know, and you can imagine them, you know, sitting at the board in the Pentagon, game planning all the different maneuvers and the timing and the different moving the pieces, the different, you know, military apparatus around like chess pieces. I think we've been subjected to exactly the same process, and we've had basically an operation that had many different pieces, you know, allied against us. I think that obviously COVID was, you know, the kickoff.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have the Black Lives Matter, you know, it's the business with, you know, the suffocation, the visual graphic, you know, pictures of this guy being suffocated. But then you had such an escalation of kind of the power of political correctness directed against white people. I've never seen such an extraordinary escalation in the media of basically the, charges against the white race in general. I mean, this is just extraordinary. And at the same time, you know, they start pulling the statues down.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you think about even the phrase Black Lives Matter, you know, it has the corollary of like white lives don't, which is basically the message, you know, that a lot of the academics that are like proponing Black Lives Matter. And then, you know, I think like one of the most important bits of information that I've heard is one that you brought out when you read the mission statement of Black Lives Matter. I think that's just absolutely critical for everyone to understand and to look at very carefully, because you can see that Black Lives Matter is an artificial creation, and that it was created by the people who are creating global HOMO, right? I mean, if you look at that mission statement where they're talking about, you know, promoting transgenderism and a queer world and getting rid of the family, I mean, this has nothing to do with the historical struggle against racism that, you know, black people, you know, who are, you know, trying to recover from slavery have been dealing with. I mean, that mission statement could only have been created by, you know, someone who had kind of the technical understanding of the project of the weaponization of sexuality, you know, with pornography, with abortion, with the destruction of the family. I mean, that statement's very sophisticated and has nothing to do with the struggle of black lives. In fact, the mission statement is so transparent in that it shows that black lives don't matter. You see what I mean? The people who are writing this, they could care less about black lives. In fact, to them, they're just puppets, because you are basically promoting the same degenerate cultural apparatus that got the entire positive momentum of African Americans that was occurring in the 50s to reverse. And suddenly the misery index just went up in every single aspect because of the Great Society, so-called Great Society program. So whoever created that, whoever is pulling the strings of Black Lives Matter, they are representing the secret society and the destruction of, you know, of the Europeans, but also of enslavement of the entire world. And it is plugged into a larger structure. I mean, obviously. I mean, let's just be real. The secret society is operating against us in every way right now. The media, the academics, the government, and state government, you know, have all been organized against us. And because of the lockdown, I think we were kind of not able psychologically, you know, we just didn't have the wit, because we had been dealing with this other issue, to basically try to respond against this insane escalation of political correctness, you know, that was so hate-filled and basically, you know, was basically justifying violence against white people, you know, because they had been they were promoting racism. And beyond that, I mean, every government, you know, I get lots of emails from government places that I'm plugged into trying to get, you know, give them information about what it's like in the real world. And every one of them had a Black Lives Matter sort of declaration.
Yeah, my bank, my insurance company, Juneteenth pops up on my Google calendar.
Yeah.
For the first time, by the way. It's like, Juneteenth. I mean, do we have a date? Oh, it's June 19th. You're just too lazy to say June 19th. Okay. Juneteenth now became, our governor declared it to be a holiday. So, and this is because apparently this was emancipation in Texas, 1865, whatever. But now apparently it wasn't really something until 1980 or something. And, but again, it just pops up again. This is all part of the, I do think, yeah, people have drawn the comparison. This, the whole thing, sort of a pogrom or like a struggle session, and that the 2/3 white majority of the country was forced into. And you're right. All of a sudden, this broad, almost universal corporate governmental support for this thing, this struggle session, this pogrom, and for Black Lives Matter being lavished with foundation and corporate funding, despite the fact that not their proclamations are, you know, probably outside what 75% of the public would be against, just, you know, destroying the family. What is this?
What percentage of black people would be opposed to it?
Yeah. And then, you know, it's a queer going against, you know, opposing cisgender, all this terminology is like, and this justifies broad-based, you know, corporate support. I mean, and if you speak out against it, you can lose your job. And you hold this rhetoric of silence is violence, where now if you don't say anything positive about Black Lives Matter, you're guilty of racism. It's not what you say, it's what you don't say. So this is, and some people compared this to the Cultural Revolution in China. And of course, the Cultural Revolution in China lasted roughly 1966 to 1976. It was launched under the direction of the Chinese Communist Party under Chairman Mao. He wished to supposedly to renew the spirit of the revolution. The revolution become too bureaucratic, according to him. Some people say that it was his attempt to reassert power over the party and over China after the failure of the Great Leap Forward and the criticism that he had gotten after he urged 100 flowers to bloom. And so everyone criticized him. This also exposed his critics. And then he was able to unleash this Cultural Revolution. It was carried out through these Maoist Red Guards, urban youths that were created through a mass mobilization effort. They were directed to root out those among the country's population who weren't sufficiently revolutionary. I guess their silence was violence as well. Suspected of bourgeois values, the Red Guards had little oversight. They were kind of let loose. They were even allowed to ride the trains for free so they could circulate throughout the country. The Red Guards were soon reined in, though, and the although the brutality of the revolution continued, the revolution saw high-ranking communist officials falling in, some out of favor. Deng Xiaoping, Lian Bao were two of them. It didn't really end until Mao's death in September 1976. After the death of Mao, this is when the Gang of Four trials, these four, radical pro-Maoists, so this is also including Mao's wife, I think, and they were all tried, and the revolution, of course, left many people dead. Some say as many as 2 million died during this phase. It displaced millions of people, completely disrupted China's, the country's economy and culture. It waged war against what they call the four olds, basically disrupting traditional culture. Now, what was the objective of that? Something you could just say it was Mao's objective to maintain control of the party. But this did set the stage after Mao's death in the late 70s for the sort of this reform in China, this gradual development of sort of state capitalism in China. And this is where it gets interesting, because you have to look back at the history. Why was there a communist revolution in China to begin with? And, of course, Mao, we now know that Mao was a Yale man. I think it was Anthony Sutton who wrote about this. He said that he predicted this in 1984. He said, by or about the year 2000, Communist China will be a superpower built by American technology and skill. And that's exactly what happened in the 80s and 90s. Of course, Mao was a Yale, and Yale was the home of Skull and Bones. Skull and Bone, their tactic was or is to reach out to all the leaders around the world, and this may explain why George W. Bush was so interested in China. Of course, Skull and Bones is a secret fraternity at Yale University, which restricts their membership to only 15 per year. Society was formed in 1832. By William Russell, whose shipping firm had made a lot of money in the opium trade. In fact, I think it was this fortune that funded, funded the founding of Skull and Bones.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And of course, Yale itself was founded by Eli Yale, his fortune was made during the opium smuggling, the British East India Company. Skull and Bones became recruiting grounds for the preserve of most of the important New England-centered families. Families also made their money in the opium trade. This would be the Coffins, the Sloans, the Tafts, the Bundys, the Paines, the Whitneys. They were all dominant elements in the Eastern establishment. This, of course, the OSS and CIA was formed around the Skull and Bones nucleus. George H.W. Bush, this was the first diplomatic representative to the People's Republic of China in 1973. Of course, he was a member of Skull and Bones. So it was his father, his brother, son, uncle, nephew, and several cousins. I think with only one exception during the Carter administration, every ambassador to China, People's Republic, has been a Skull and Bones member. But this is where it gets interesting. We don't know about Mao's history. Is that in 1903, the Yale Divinity School established a number of schools and hospitals throughout China that were collectively known as Yale in China. It has since been shown that Yale in China was, of course, part of an intelligence network to pursue what was basically to disrupt the formation of a Republican government under Sun Yat-sen on the behalf of the Anglo-American establishment. They didn't want China to develop. They wanted to keep it poor, and the new communists would keep it poor. And also, the communists were committed to large production of opium. So they were consistent with the interest of the Eastern establishment. During World War II, Yale in China was a primary instrument used by U.S. establishment and its Office of Strategic Services. And it was through there that I think they were able to install the Maoist regime in 1949. I guess with the Nationalists losing favor with them, Chiang Kai-shek, who I guess another faction, who was supported by another faction of the establishment, who also was heavily involved in the opium trade. So that's kind of the background. So you understand, look at the Great Cultural Revolution in China and the disruption it caused. Mao was installed by the Eastern establishment to disrupt China. So given that context, what do we make of our own Cultural Revolution? Well, at least with Mao, they maintained a Chinese identity. And still to this day, the People's Republic of China, the Communist Party, does see itself as uniquely Chinese. And there's some debate to what extent it opposes the West and what extent it's in bed with them. There's probably some debate, and there's probably some real debate within the Chinese system, as there in any, and I think in any system, it's not going to be completely monolithic. But we have to ask ourselves, what does it say about what we're experiencing today with this attempted cultural revolution in America, this anti-white program, hating whitey, the struggle session, the destruction of statues, the toppling of more than 150 statues. I think most recently, a statue of an abolitionist was toppled in Minnesota. The statue of U.S. Grant was toppled because he supposedly, so now they're taking down Lee and Grant. Abraham Lincoln's statue has been defaced. Most interesting enough, Albert Pike's statue was taken down by a mob.
Yeah, that was interesting. Yeah,
very interesting. But thing about it, what's interesting is that all these statues, local police and governments have the resources to protect them. They're letting this happen. A few judges are ordering the removal because they see the statues as a nuisance because they invite violence, you see. So they're allowing property to be destroyed. Local officials.
But the idea, of course, is that these are being portrayed as just white males who were basically promoting slavery.
Mm-hmm.
This is where the normies, you know, understanding of history takes them. They just buy it. All of the people you mentioned just happened to be Freemasons. I mean, Albert Pike, for God's sakes. And yet that background isn't really being presented. It's a shame it isn't. You know, sort of like when they defaced the Churchill's statue. I mean, this is a great thing to do, but not in the context of, well, he's a white male racist.
Yeah.
Because that is basically focusing the hatred onto the wrong group. The group you want to focus it on is the group that they all of these people came from, that they were part of. The average white individual was as much a victim as anyone else. I mean, for heaven's sakes, we're the ones that went over the top into automatic weapon fire.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, you know, you have to look at Freemasonry, which was controlling all of this. I mean, when you look at the opium trade and you know, and how it would, you know, set up Yale and then all of the Chinese leaders were being funded through basically the descendants of the Freemason opium trade. I mean, they're in control to this very day over that country. You know? So it is not correct to focus this hatred onto white people in general. This is one thing that I hope the independent media does a better job of, because this is information that really isn't getting out very often in the independent media. I mean, a lot of stuff it brings out is terrific, but it doesn't do a good job of trying to get people to focus on what organization is really in operation. Where is the centrifugal energy for all of these different, you know, nefarious acts in history over the last 200 years, because it comes back to these two groups, the Jewish banking families and Freemasonry.
Yeah, they're at the top of this. They're the ones, I think, controlling the dialectic, and that's why they've stoked a race war to distract, from their looting and their ultimate objective, which is they're calling it a Great Reset. That's what the World Economic Forum is calling it.
Yeah,
you have a couple. One thing is. The way the Cultural Revolution is being waged is that it's been planned for a long time, and they've been able to do this. One thing is through kind of stoking racial animosity and also a sense of entitlement and grievances among the black population. That's why the New York Times last year started that 1619 project to see American history solely in racial terms, you know, despite the fact, I think up until 1750, the majority of slaves in America were white. You mentioned last week about the experience of the Irish. They were sold off into slavery by supposedly their fellow white man. So much for white unity. But there was Cromwell and so, you know, King John King James, rather.
King James.
And of course, millions of whites were sold into slavery, to the Barbary pirates, and of course throughout Africa, slavery itself. The big partners in that were blacks themselves. The kingdom, I think, the kingdom was a Dahomey who were in league, with the white slave traders selling off, their fellow countrymen, if you will, or I guess they didn't have countries. These were tribes that have lost the war, and they were selling those men into slavery. Of course, they were the Arab slave traders who much more vicious and brutal than the Western slave trade, which isn't required that they apologize for that. There's no demand for Arabs to apologize for that. It seems to be only white European Christian culture seems to be targeted in this revolution.
When in fact, that was the one group that actually stood up against slavery and eventually had created enough political resistance to put an end to it. It would be great to work with black intellectuals on a project to get to the bottom of who created slavery.
Well, the Nation of Islam.
Who benefited?
Yeah.
Because, you mentioned obviously there were groups in Africa, Arabs and
blacks themselves.
And black Africans.
Yeah.
But from there, how does the business aspect run? Who were the people in Newport, Rhode Island, that were running the slave ships? Who are these people? Where does the financing come from? Is the Rothschild family involved in any of this? Mm-hmm. Because if you start getting a good understanding of the business of slavery, not the aspect of running slaves in America, because there certainly were a lot of Europeans that participated in that heinous activity. It was just the nature of the economics, the reality that people were dealing with. Mm-hmm. Couldn't have a plantation without slave labor, and plantation was where you could mass produce plants and grow cotton. Not trying to justify it, it's just that and happy to take the idea of anger and guilt directed toward these the people who participated in it, but they are not one business of slavery. The business of slavery is inside Africa, and it's inside groups that are making money on this transaction. So that really is what it would be great to see focused on. Particularly black intellectuals should be the ones taking the lead in this. They'd have more access to the media than like independent researchers bringing information out. So this would be a great cause for black intellectuals to break free from the academic slavery that they find themselves in, where they're just parroting ideas that are coming from the secret society that are designed to keep them, enslaved and obedient. So this would be a great project. I don't know if it is going to happen, but it sure would be one that I would support if it started to take place.
Well, I think the Nation of Islam did a series of books on this, like Believe. Yeah. But then that is Amazon has since pulled it off their inventory.
They pulled it off, yeah. Like yeah. They also pull E. Michael Jones books off last week?
Yeah, Z books were taken off, yeah. So
just raw censorship.
Yep. Can't have that. but I mean, a lot of this, like kind of the, well, one of the things is black entitlement and black anger being stoked by like the 1619 Project, just the overall education, the schools, it's very, what they're given in history is very crude, very simplistic, moralistic in a way, like a comic book, like with the civil rights, there's Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King, then maybe you hear about the Holocaust and there's no complexity beyond that. And this is a certain narrative that's taught. So people are prepared for this.
Tim, I just want to interject. There's a new curriculum that has been developed, and I actually talked with an individual today about it. He's the same gentleman who had given me an eye on the ground of CHAZ, the autonomous zone, which, of course, as you know, collapsed. they couldn't get even like, 10 people together, and so it just disappeared, which we had predicted last week. But anyway, he called me and we spoke, and he said that in Cupertino and also in Seattle, they are now insisting that the school kids promote Black Lives Matter with signage on their homes that they will then photograph and bring back for class credit. I mean, it's insane, but this is this individual is, I am sure, 100% reliable, very, very reliable, clear-minded individual. And he said this is actually going on today. So they have transitioned from a protest. I mean, what was Black Lives Matter, a year ago? And now they are basically becoming the curriculum in public schools.
Is there any discussion about a lot of the, I guess, events that Black Lives Matter protests have been proven to be hoaxes?
Well, is there any discussion on the long-term societal effects of implementing the mission statement with the global homo and transgender and getting rid of the nuclear family? Is that something that you can bring to the PTA for discussion?
It's really, this idea that they'd be subjecting children to, that type of controversy and not that is sort of psychological warfare, because you're telling them a lot of these, presumably a lot of these children are white. And so they're just instilling that guilt into them, which will disable them from resisting. This plan, for destroying it. I mean, you have Noel Ignatieff, the professor who talked about we have to destroy white people? I mean, he was a tenured professor, and you have that idiot Dr. Wise. He talks about how whiteness, how children, white kids should be subjected to violence that's common in black areas, so they're no longer protected from this, so they can grow up and have a real experience. Of course,
one woman professor was saying that white lives don't matter as white lives.
Yes.
The idea of whiteness was not just passé, but destructive to the future of civilization they're creating. Yeah. So, I mean, the gloves are off.
It's like the whole idea of the civil rights movement, we've talked about this in the past, was the reason why the white majority supported the Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act, trillions of dollars in welfare and great society programs. I mean, they pretty much in kind or in total, they've gotten their reparations and all these programs, affirmative action programs, set-asides, special status in law, like civil rights laws and things like this. That if you do all these things, that the black underclass, they're underclass because of Jim Crow or segregation or unequal treatment, if you do away with these impediments to black advancement and legal equality, that the black population become largely middle class values. But that hasn't how it's worked out. Is now the values, the idea was extending the privileges of the of America to this marginalized underclass, this minority, and lifting them up, or letting themselves, better yet, letting themselves work their way up to enjoy the fruits, you know, of American society. Now American society is being trashed and torn down. I mean, if it's so bad in America, go somewhere else. I mean, if white people are so evil, why do you constantly claim the right to live next to white people in and around them? I mean, if it is so bad, I mean, it begs the question.
Of course. I mean, the idea was that they would sell the Great Society programs as bootstrap, mm-hmm. and this was would enable the African American to become like the white middle class. They would have the educational levels, the work ethic. This was how it was presented. I mean, go back and look at the literature when they were trying to sell the Great Society program. But this was never the plan. The plan was rap culture. Mm-hmm. That was really the what was the affirmative action that the owners of our government had in mind. That was obviously where they were going to take it. You just look at like the CIA's participation in the drug interjection, right? You look at pornography, right? You look at the heroization of the pimp. I mean, from Hollywood, they sold the image of the bootstrap American black family coming up into the middle class with these, you know, like affirmative action, for example. Well, this is like feminism. I mean, now we're, like 60 years into the program, and it isn't just a disaster. It has literally been a U-turn against civilization. I mean, the family has disintegrated. The murder rates are through the roof. The economy, is, in many cases, is simply illegal drugs and criminality. So there are places, you know, which were supposed to have been helped by these programs, which have obviously just been destroyed. And nowhere in that whole trajectory was there like any kind of soul searching by government employees about, well, maybe we're doing something wrong with our programs, right? Because everything is turning to crap. So you know that this was larger forces in play. And now this was, you know, they were bringing us to this moment where you have Black Lives Matter with the absolute power of the state. I mean, this is like a Roman state religion where the Senate has simply decreed it and it's going to be enforced by military. You know, that's why I am worried about the police standing down. I mean, I think they're obviously entitled at this point to that position, but they are, I think, to some extent, still reflecting of, middle class culture in America. And so who else is going to defend us? You know, I mean, basically, if the police stand down or are defunded, and incidentally, look at the chanting that Black Lives Matter was doing to the lines of policemen. They were chanting, "You're going to lose your job. You're going to lose your job." Did you see any of these protests where they were doing that? Mm-hmm. They were chanting, "You're going to lose the job." So this was obviously the idea of standing down and defunding the police. These were ideas that were in play, you know, way before the protests started. This was the plan, was to basically separate the police from culture so that you'd now have the white middle class, what's left of it, basically, you know, surrounded seemingly by Antifa and by the new community policing organizations like we saw in the autonomous zone. So this was where we are is where they wanted to take us. I would think that, to resist is really, how to resist is really important. And promoting, like sheriffs through elections that are going to stand up for the people. And of course, trying to find a way to bring the police their morale back. you know, so that they're willing to make sacrifices to not be simply, you know, leave their positions, walk away because there's been this negative publicity, you know, hurled against them. I read that in Manhattan that 5% of the population has already left. They've moved. They just simply took off. I think that this is going to happen almost in a lot of the big cities, Tim, where the people who have the financial ability, which is to say typically the whites, will leave. Now, what will happen to these cities now without kind of these groups that provided a lot of the jobs and taxation? Well, the cities will just turn to the federal government. They'll become slave colonies of the federal government. But boy, I would not want to be inside any of these cities if you're like a white person, because this would be like being in South Africa after, you know, the independence, being a Boer, you know, where because you'd have hatred and you'd have no real recourse legally, you know, because the legal system, I think, is going to be handed over to Black Lives Matter.
Well, we're seeing that with the arrest and indictment of those two officers down in Atlanta.
Yes, exactly. Where
it's obviously that if you saw his arraignment, he's in a room full of blacks, and the corruption in the Atlanta government. Atlanta government is just it's notorious, and even the district attorney down there is under investigation for embezzlement. But it doesn't matter what the facts are. These officers may or may not be acquitted, but it's almost like in the George Floyd case where they hand down these heavy charges, which cannot possibly in a fair trial, you know, get a conviction on. But even if they get acquitted, they'll have a pretext for yet another riot, whenever they want. Particularly egregious is that incident down in the Wendy's, again, where the black assailants are lionized as great men when you know, both of them have rap sheets a mile long, drug dealing. One was an aspiring porn star. The other was in jail for child cruelty, and he was only furloughed because of COVID-19. And he was headed back if he that's one of the reasons why he ran, perhaps. But then we're told that he was a loving father in the media. And the media said he was arrested for sleeping in the car. Well, no, it was a lot more to it than that. He was pummeling one of the officers on top of him, punching him.
Right, he stole.
He stole a weapon.
So there isn't any real charges that can be brought against the officers. I saw the episode. It's tragic, and you wonder if there would be training that could keep these kind of situations from coming to death. But just on an existential level, you know, the guy, basically there is self-defense. So how can you even have these charges? But this is, we're looking at a process, and it goes back, you can certainly pick it up like 100 years ago, but certainly from the end of World War II with the attack on the ethnic neighborhoods in the city, with the creation of the white middle class, with the creation of the pornographic male and the single mother. Right. Mm-hmm. Then with political correctness, I mean, basically, this is just the final chapter of what was in started with the Macy conference and, MK Ultra and all of the ideas of shattering a white middle class culture. And ultimately, this goes into the Brave New World, where the state will control the production of humans. I read today that in New Jersey, which has the highest autism rate, the latest statistics, and I mean, I haven't vetted this, but I certainly read this from a credible source. It's 1 in 20, 5% of the kids. Yeah, 5%. So you're really heading to the Delta and Epsilon production. You know, you're getting into basically almost a mature, brave new world society at this point.
Yeah, I mean, if you're autistic, you're not going to question illegal lockdowns and public health hoaxes. We see the public authorities and even celebrities taking knees, apologizing, asking for black forgiveness. You know, it's absurd. Of course, what these apologies reinforce is the idea that whites in general are all guilty.
Of course.
It's guilt by association. And, you know, we had the example of the stepmother of the Atlanta police officer who was charged in the Rayshard Brooks death, was fired for her job because of her relations to her son. That's just absurd. Apparently, a black woman fired her. Well, that's something that was said there. The group Lady Antebellum announced that they were changing the name to Lady A, because Antebellum, of course, means existing before the war. It's pre-war South. I mean, so the culture, you're gone with the wind. You can't get on Netflix anymore, apparently, or Amazon, or what it was. I mean, come on. I mean, it's a cultural purge. What they're doing is they're erasing United States history as a country. America is being canceled. America is becoming a target of the cancel culture, and it's being pushed by the New York Times. It's being pushed by the Ford Foundation, by Soros Open Society, by all the major corporations and banks. So why is this happening? Why is indeed Western culture on the chopping block? It's itself is being canceled. You have to ask yourself these things. And so what's the ultimate objective here? You know,
and at the same time, when we're told to wear a mask, social distance, you know, and
yeah, yeah. Unless you're rioting or I mean protesting.
Right.
And then what this idiot Sean King, he's evil. Of course, he was one of the founding members of Black Lives Matter. I think he was purged because he wasn't black enough or something. I don't know. But he says you have to smash all images of Jesus Christ because he's too white. I mean, this is the type of rhetoric you're hearing. Now they're going to start targeting the churches. They took down a statue in San Francisco of St. Junius of Para. I think he was the missionary who established a lot of the Catholic missions in that part of the world, in the Southwest. This helped form the whole culture there. It just predates the United States. And that statue was torn down. What's the point of that? So what we're seeing here is a cultural revolution that's being waged to destroy the history of the country. And what's the ultimate objective there?
I would just characterize it as what is being demonstrated or projected as a culture war. See, I really believe that there really isn't a culture war per se, because that implies, you know, spontaneity and history unfolding. I mean, what you have is a project from the society. In fact, like I was thinking when you were talking about the Chicago mayor who had that exchange with I believe it was a Latino alderman, and he was just aghast that there hadn't been police protection and how, you know, the rioting was just out of control. And she was she used obscenities toward him and said, "I know you want to pray." You know, like, in other words, demeaning him as basically that this idea about white praying is, a trivial aspect of a dying culture. And then remember de Blasio's comment, right, about when he was asked, well, why can't we open up churches if you're permitting these protests? And he just blew it off saying, this is like important where you just want to go to your church and pray. But I think these are basically ways of kind of programming white Christian culture to see itself in inferior cultural role, that you are not in control of the country. It's just the opposite. It's Black Lives Matter, and you are reflecting this evil past, and therefore you don't even have the moral authority to be part of the election process. You know, that's how evil you are. So, you know, we need to, you know, keep our balance through this and keep it, you know, basically reminding one another that this is propaganda. When you address it straight on, I think the very worst thing you can do is try to like engage someone like this in anything other than a direct attack against them as being an agent of evil. Because if you try to get into, well, you know, what was slavery, or, you know, what do blacks deserve because of all of the races? I mean, it's like, you know, arguing with, you know, against a feminist, is there, what about equal pay for, you know, equal work? I mean, if you engage in that level, it's just a waste of time. You always will lose the argument because they will have the moral anger and authority. You have to change gears. You have to say, you know, you're an agent of an evil secret society, and you are operating in as a tool of propaganda. That's the truth, and that's where you have the basis to really have a discussion.
Yeah, look at this. Cultural Revolution, I think, is a setup for, you know, this Great Reset that the World Economic Forum is openly talking about. I think it's a theme with their meeting next year in Davos. Yep. This is the reset. Take it back to the Rockefellers in Mao in 1973, November, I think, in August of 73, David Rockefeller wrote an editorial praising Mao. After a trip to China, David Rockefeller praised Mao, who had slaughtered over 40 million people. His report from a China traveler highlights the goals presented in the UN report, such as the Commission on Global Governance. And he wrote, one is impressed immediately by the sense of national harmony. Whatever the price of the Chinese Revolution has obviously succeeded in fostering high morale and community purpose. General social economic progress is no less impressive. The enormous social advance of China have benefited us greatly from, the enormous social advances of China have benefited greatly singleness of ideology and purpose. The social experiment in China under Chairman Mao leadership is one of the most important and successful in history. This was, of course, 7 years into the Great Cultural Revolution. It was a disaster, but he loved it. And why is that? And you have to ask yourself why... the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, have funded the various elements of the feminist movement, gender studies movement in the late 1960s. The feminists, you know, so basically all this radical leftist stuff was funded by all these billionaires. These radicals were establishment funded. So was it speak for their genuine role as radicals? Was it controlled opposition?
And the the thing is, if you look at like the Freemason control of the opium trade, right, the lodge system in India, and then the direct gunboat diplomacy in China, and then where they set up the triads, right, who all had Masonic, symbols and handshakes and stuff, and were under control, just like basically Prince Hall, you know, would be in black controlled Freemason in the United States. So those guys are running it. And then, like, for example, the Roosevelt family, just, you know, as an example of, you know, you move in time a little bit and you can see the connection into like a contemporary oligarchs. So then when you look at like the Ford Foundation and all of these structures, aren't they just basically replacing the Freemason control over China with the same group with a new name?
It was Richard Gardner. I mean, he was the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State under Kennedy and Johnson, and a member, of course, of the Trilateral Commission.
Yeah.
And he wrote in 1974 in the Council on Foreign Relations, Foreign Affairs, their flagship, you know, publication, Hard Road to World Order. This is 1974. In short, the house of the world order will have to be built from the bottom up rather from the bottom down, better from the top down. It will look like a great booming, buzzing confusion, to use William James' famous description of reality, but an end run around national sovereignty, eroding it in pieces, eroding it piece by piece, will accomplish much more than the old-fashioned frontal assault. So that's the very strategy you're talking about. And that's, I think, what we're seeing play out today, perhaps the latter stages of it. There is an article that I came across about this sort of connects the Great Reset with the COVID-19 panic and the riots. Let me see here. Yeah, the globalists reveal the great economic reset is coming. This is by Brandon Smith, and he writes, for those not familiar with the phrase global economic reset, it is one that has been used ever increasingly by elitists in the central banking world for several years. I first heard it referenced by Christine Lagarde, the head of the IMF at the time in 2014. The reset is often mentioned in the same breath as ideas like new multilateralism or multipolar world order or new world order. All the phrases mean essentially the same thing. Many alternative economists have wrongly attributed the Fed's habits of making things worse to hubris and ignorance. They think the Fed actually wants to save the financial system, protect the golden goose. But this is not reality. The truth is the Fed is not a bumbling maintenance man. The Fed is a saboteur, a suicide bomber that is willing to destroy even itself as an institution in order to explode the U.S. economy and clear the path for a new globally centralized one-world system, hence the global reset. In 2015, in my article, The Global Economic Reset Has Begun, I stated, the global reset is not a response to a process of collapse we are trapped in today. No, the global reset, as implemented by central banks and the Bank of International Settlements and International Monetary Fund, is the cause of the collapse. The collapse is a tool, a flamethrower burning a great hole in the forest to make way for foundations for a globalist ziggurat to be built. Economic disaster serves the interest of elitists. Now in 2020, we are seeing the globalist plan coming to fruition, with elites revealing what appears to be their intent to launch their reset in 2021. The World Economic Forum officially announced the Great Reset Initiative as part of their covert action plan last week, and a summit is scheduled for January 2021 to discuss their plans more openly with the world and the mainstream media. The reset, according to discussions by the IMF, is basically the next stage in the formation of a one-world economic system, potential global government. This seems to fall in line with the solutions offered during the Event 201 pandemic simulation, a simulation of a coronavirus pandemic that was held by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the World Economic Forum only 2 months before the real thing happened at the beginning of 2020. It is not convenient. It is not convenient that the events of the real coronavirus pandemic fall exactly in line with the Event 201 simulation, as well as directly in line with the global reset plans of the IMF and the World Economic Forum. As they are, let no crisis go to waste, or as the motto of the globalists, order out of chaos. So, you know, he continues, with the civil unrest about to become a way of life for many parts of the world, including the U.S., and the pandemic set for a resurgence of infections after reopening, creating a rationale for a second wave of lockdowns, probably in July, the economy as we know it will be destroyed. The last vestiges of the system hanging by a thin thread after the crash of 2008 are now being cut.
Who wrote that?
Brandon Smith.
Okay, well written and well said. Quite accurate. I mean, so basically what you're going to have is the destruction of the dollar and the euro and the yen and the yuan, I would imagine. And so the financial index will collapse. It won't be working in terms of international trade and food, things like this. So they will have to have a new currency, which will be a worldwide currency that will be electronic, social credit, kind of based system. And then at the same time, because there's going to be so much chaos, there'll be martial law, and so then there'll be basically military in control of the streets. What was left of democracy will be completely gone. There won't be elections. I would imagine the internet will be taken away too. As soon as the military on the street, I would suspect the internet will go shortly after that. And then the individuals will be left with whatever community and resources they're able to basically put together, because you have to see how lethal and dangerous these people are. To have, when you look at World War I or World War II, you can see that the Georgia Guidestone numbers are not something that are theoretical or, you know, impossible for a sane person to imagine. These are real goals. And so to get there, they're going to have to get rid of a whole bunch of people. And the condition that you can imagine occurring in 2021 is basically a worldwide homolador, mm-hmm. where there isn't enough food moving around and starvation just does the work for them. And so that's what I'm afraid of. And that's why I would say that organizing now and interacting with the political system now is really critical.
Yeah, he continues, the New World Order, the global reset, is a long-running scheme to centralize power, but in a way that is meant to be sustained for centuries to come. The elites know that it is not enough to achieve global governance by force alone. Such an attempt would only lead to resistance and eternal rebellion. No, what the elites want is for the public to ask, even beg for global governance. If the public is tricked into demanding it as a way to save them from the horrors of global chaos, then they are far less likely to rebel against it. Problem, reaction, solution. And that is very key. That's the thing is, they're creating the conditions, and you think all these are separate events. No, it's all part of an operation. This is why it's so important when they start talking about spikes in cases and resurgence and another lockdown, all this. You have to reject that. You have to resist that and say, no, we're not going to abide by this. We're not going to. And that's at the street level. Acknowledge this thing as a hoax. It's all there is never a pandemic. There is nothing out there. Effectively, there's nothing out there.
That would be my position. I think that like the bulge in deaths that occurred in April was strictly murders, basically in retirement homes of poor people.
It would appear that was one of the functions of the panic and the retirement.
Yeah. And it's very interesting statistically, because what you had in April was this, you know, because you have like the static fatality rate of, you know, a decade, and then you have COVID going along, and all of a sudden you have this spike in April, which was noticeable statistically. And if it was a real epidemic, it would have continued, but it just was this little lump, and then it went back to baseline, which it has been for the last 3 months, basically. So how could that have occurred? What could be responsible for that? I would say it was because they simply put contagious people with flus into the retirement homes that they knew they could basically kill a lot of people.
And isolating them so they get the press thing even sicker.
Yeah, that's right, at the same time. But I think that that's really what you saw was, and this wasn't in like the retirement homes for wealthy people. I think if someone, you know, if they had real reporting and they went and looked at the numbers, they'd see that this was almost exclusively poor people. Mm-hmm. These are homes which the government runs. They can't say no to any kind of, hospital action being directed toward them from the state, because they're completely dependent on state funds for their functioning. They took in these patients who had contagious respiratory diseases. The people all died in the homes. They were all labeled as COVID, but it was probably something else, I would imagine, like just the flu or some other, pneumonia. But whatever it was, it disappeared as quickly as it came. Mm-hmm. So it could not, this can't be, you know, a real epidemic. You don't get a statistical hiccup like this, because viruses would act, you know, in a mechanical and static, you know, linear fashion. So something like that is very, very suspicious. And I think you're absolutely right. The fact is, they have never produced any analysis showing that what would be saved by the lockdown, is actually more beneficial than what is lost. Mm-hmm. You know, because they say, well, you know, we can flatten the curve or whatever, you know, thing they want to talk about with COVID. But now we can really see the results. I mean, Manhattan destroyed the suicide in some cases where I've seen data is up like 12 months in a single month, 12 months of suicides. Obviously, hundreds of thousands of businesses destroyed. And so we haven't gained anything by the lockdown. It seems to me that we're facing, of course, economic catastrophe. So if they try to lock us down again, Matt, I just think we should resist with every single thing we got.
No, we're not going to do it. And then
just not going to do it. Yeah, we're not going to let
at least walk. At least foil their immediate plans and live to fight another day. And one thing you see from all this is this the destruction of small local businesses. The big corporations are able to, you know, basically pick up the slack and become more profitable. And overall assets prices will drop. So those with a lot of capital enriched by the federal we're able to buy the scarf up those properties and those assets on the cheap, pennies on the dollar. You see the business plan there. That's why Jeff Bezos and his Washington Post are printing stories about second and third waves. I mean, what interest does Jeff Bezos have in destroying brick and mortar stores? Ask yourself that question. And who is Jeff Bezos and what is the Washington Post? But yeah, what you have here, I think, with COVID was this it was part of a larger currency war to, in the immediate time, prop up the dollar, which is under heavy stress going into the summer and fall of 2019. Even Putin was talking about ending the dollar reserve status and these because of what they were doing with it. And then you had this pandemic, which, again, what does that do? Saves a dollar to live another day. But the ultimate objective then is how do you... Because the currency, the dollar had been weaponized, and people were realizing this, so they're trying to wiggle out of it. That's why you had the BRIC nations. That's why the Belt and Road Initiative and these things. It's an old game trying to get out of get out from under the dollar, which is an imperial system. But now, the international banking, the satanic cult, if you will, now wants to transition, from the dollar. Not to another currency. Maybe in the meantime, there'll be like a basket of currencies, like special drawing rights. But they want to shift to a credit system and using primarily, perhaps moving from oil, perhaps maybe to food, to control the world's economy. And they're going to do this through some sort of probably digital currency, which is not a currency at all. It's a social credit system. And they're by collapsing, by running up all this debt, suppressing suppressing real economic activity, you're creating a scenario for the collapse of all currencies, and then you get this scenario that Mr. Smith writes at it, where it's problem, reaction, solution. The collapse of the economy, we will come in with our new currency and reorder the economy. And at the same time, what they're able to do with this with the COVID-19 thing, scamdemic, was organize a huge $1 trillion bailout, $6 trillion bailout for all the usual suspects. Ordinarily, that might create a run on the dollar and an inflationary attack. But with the shutting down the economy, they created a deflationary environment. At the same time, they were giving trillions to their friends who are then in a position to recapitalize and buy up all the cheaper assets because of the depressed economy.
Yeah, at this point, it's just a transparent construction of a slave camp for Europeans and everybody else, basically, that isn't inside the Masonic.
Yeah, and a digital currency is a mechanism for slavery.
Yeah, that's all it is. Yeah. I mean, because then they know exactly, who has what, and they can take away your money anytime you're bad. If you don't like the vaccines, you're upset because, your children are autistic. Well, fine. You've just lost the ability to, eat for the next week.
Yeah, and by turning large swaths of the public, perhaps half the public, into obsessive compulsive hypochondriacs, they've made everyone very vulnerable psychologically to this type of manipulation. Fear. They've spread this.
Yeah, so I think this is a good time to organize and resist, wouldn't you, Tim?
Yes, you have to start non-compliance locally. Get involved in who your local sheriff is.
Yes, I think those are important things. And organize in terms of the community. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't care what it takes. Do it. Get some community organization set up. Come up with plans as to how to feed and protect yourself. Mm-hmm. And if possible, if you get to the point where you can do that, reach out and connect to another group. Mm-hmm. Just keep doing it. We this is how we can fight back. And I think we're going to have lots of people, as they say, waking up soon. because when the beginning of the slave state, you know, is apparent to everyone, I think people will start realizing that the ideas of the independent media were correct and that mainstream media is simply propaganda.
Yeah, it's fairly obvious now if you watch the news. Maybe that's how I am when I watch it.
Could be, yeah.
You know, so, okay, Joe. Like I said, don't want to black pill people on this. It's bad news.
Yeah, but it's the black pill people that have to make the transition. And it's this is the time right now.
Well, it's an opportunity. Whereas, again, I said this, they've made this great leap forward, if you will, in this march towards the New World Order, but they've gone out on a limb here. They've exposed themselves, and now they're vulnerable. And it's just a question of making up enough of the public that they react to it.
Yeah. I mean, like Bill Gates, for example, has become exposed.
Yes.
So, you know, this is what we have to expose all of it, not just one.
I was just wondering, I realized the COVID-19 scare is making a comeback. I saw it starting in the headlines and what is happening, you know, the tri-state with Connecticut, New York, New Jersey. And they're trying to scare people with stories in Texas and Florida about cases going up. So last night I go to the gym to get some exercise, and I'm in there. I'm surrounded by people, some people wearing masks, some people not, whatever. And they have these television screens, stations, and I'm watching CNN. And the sound is down, but I look up from my exercising machine. I stare up at the screen, and lo and behold, it's Bill Gates on CNN with the doctor and also Anderson Cooper. And Bill Gates is there for a good 35 minutes just talking with, you know, the sound is down, but I can almost hear his voice anyway. And his hands are waving, and he's wearing a sweater, even though it's June. And he's waving his hands, talking, and probably explaining how wonderful his vaccine is going to be and how he has to, you know, be in charge of this plan to, I guess, save the planet from the dreaded diseases that his vaccines are there to save us from.
You know, I just why for a disease with a CDC admitted recovery rate of 99.974 would you even need to develop a vaccine?
Joe, you're not supposed to think about that. You're supposed to see the headlines and get scared.
And get scared, yeah.
So it's just funny. It's like, here we go again. But I'm not sensing, I'm just not sensing the reaction. The fear isn't there anymore. People are fatigued of this or just tired of it. And I don't think they're going to get quite the compliance they got the first time around. Hopefully that'll be the basis for a rebellion.
I think, you know what, Tim? I think it could be a great moment for the independent media, for us, because there are so many people that are sick of it. And a lot of the people that are sick of it are starting to wonder about just the rationale for the whole thing.
Yes.
Like I know someone who purportedly has COVID. He's in his 80s and he's just fine. And he's basically over it. Even though I don't even know if he tested positive, he didn't feel well, and then now he's better after 3 or 4 days. He's the only person I know out of, like, you know, and just, you can imagine my vast social network here, like 5 people. But I mean, I know people, and no one has it. No one is sick. How are they going to, you know, run this movie a second time? I think this could be a good moment. We could see real acceleration. And this is, I hope everyone who's in the independent world, the not in the dependent media side, but the independent media, everybody, this is our moment. We have to stand up, raise our voice, and just keep pushing forward. There's been a lot of great exposés of Bill Gates. We got to broaden that into the whole society that Gates is part of.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay, Joe, enjoy your weekend.
Hey, you too, Tim. Keep exercising, and we'll talk next week, buddy.
Good night, then. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.